I do appreciate, always appreciate the opportunity to come out here and spend part of a Sabbath with you, and especially Marjolaine was able to come with me today, so we enjoy coming out this way, and I enjoy it a lot better when she's with me, so nice for us all to be able to be together here today. Let's see if we're getting everything set up. What I thought I would do, I've done this in a couple of other congregations already, is give you a little bit of an update on a very full and productive trip that we made during the period of the Spring Holy Days. And I think it's good for us from time to time. I don't always do that, but every once in a while I think it's interesting for you to see some pictures and hear some stories about what's going on in the lives of your brethren in other parts of the world. And so that's what I would like to do. We'll do that for the first part, and then I'm going to save about 15 or 20 minutes at the end, and I'll share a couple of scriptures with you, which I think you'll find interesting and meaningful in the light of some of the things that I'll have to tell you here today. So I want to make sure, okay, it looks like we're ready to go. So I'm just going to launch in, and this is something that the Apostle Paul did at times. We have a reference in, I think it's Acts 14, to after he came back from a long trip. It says he gathered the whole church together, and he told them everything that God had done with him, and how God had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles, and there was a lot of rejoicing in the church. I think it's important for you to be aware of what's going on in other parts of the world, because you're helping to make it happen. By your prayers, by your tithes and offerings, you are supporting the work that the church does, not only in the United States, but all around the world. And the people that you see, some of the photos that you're going to see here today, are people who, every time I go, there are people who say, please thank our brethren in other parts of the world. Thank our American brethren and our European brethren who are helping to make these trips possible. For a lot of these people, they only see a minister a couple of times a year. And so these visits are real lifelines. It's rather odd to think about, but for some of the people that I go to visit, for example, I may be, and now Daniel Harper, who is traveling with me, you'll see some photos of that, we're the only people outside of their country that they have ever seen associated with a church. They see themselves, they see the people in their congregation, and they just don't have visitors because of how, well, you have to speak French to be able to do it, and then it's off the beaten track to get there, and I'll share a little bit of that with you as we go along here. So let's just jump in on it here, and I'll first of all show you the itinerary. This was a four-week trip through French parts of Africa. And I probably mentioned to you when I've talked about this before, France was a great colonizing power, like England was, not quite as much as England was in the past. That's, you know, we used to say the sun never sat on the English empire, and that's true. But France also had colonies in many different parts of the world, including a lot in Africa. So there are many African countries where French is the main European language that's spoken. So that's why we're going to be visiting a number of countries. Our first stop was Ivory Coast, and we'll be seeing some shots of that in a moment. Then we flew over to Lomé in Togo. From there we went to Cameroon, and I'll explain the situation there. It's very challenging and a bit dangerous for some of our brethren in that area. We went down to Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, also a very difficult place to live. Then we had to connect through Nairobi, and we had tickets and we were all set to go to Burundi, but if you've been following the international news at all, you know that there's a lot of civil unrest centering on a presidential election that's coming up. There's been a lot of violence, there was a coup attempt, and it looks at this point as if the country may be sliding into civil war. They've had civil war in the past in Burundi. They managed to patch together a political fix, which included the current president serving two terms. Well, he's got a technicality now where he thinks he should be able to run for a third term. And so the violence is happening in the streets now. So we, after checking with U.S. authorities and checking with our brethren on the ground in Burundi, I made the decision that we would not go in there. And in hindsight, it was a wise decision. We ended up spending a couple of extra days in Kenya before going on to Rwanda, which was our last stop in Africa, and then we flew back out again. So that's the itinerary. I wanted to show you that up front, and now we'll go in and I'll show you a little bit of what happened during our stay in different places. This is Abidjan, the economic capital of Côte d'Ivoire, as the name is the country's known. Its official name is in French, Côte d'Ivoire. It means Ivory Coast. And sometimes people call it Ivory Coast, but officially it's the French name. And as you can see, there's quite a good infrastructure in Abidjan. Côte d'Ivoire was supposed to be one of the success stories of what happens when you are a former French colony. France invested a lot of money. They helped develop their cocoa industry. every time you eat a chocolate candy bar, part of that came, almost certainly part of it came from Ivory Coast. They do more than 90% of the world's cocoa production. So when cocoa prices are good, things are good. When cocoa prices are not so good, things can be very difficult for them. They just came through a 10-year civil war, which ended just a couple of years ago. It ended with a final crescendo of a battle right in Abidjan. The rebel forces had moved through the country. The president actually went down to a fortified bunker underneath his palace, and they had to blast him out with artillery. He's awaiting trial now in the world court, I think it is. So the fighting happened right in the middle of Abidjan. And I came in shortly after that was over and made some visits there. And a lot of the windows on buildings like this were shot out, even as high as 20 stories up. There were just been so many bullets and artillery shells flying around. But that's all over now, so things are finally seeming to get back into some semblance of order. And when there's peace, then people can kind of get their lives back together and the economy can start moving forward again. But they're still in a rebuilding phase. About an hour's drive outside of town, depending on traffic, in a little village outside of Abidjan, the village is called Lamé, we have a little group of about 10 people who are attending services. And this is their church hall. This was what they asked us to build for them, and we were able to do it, as you can imagine, pretty inexpensively. Why would we build a church hall for 10 people? Why can't they just meet in somebody's living room? The answer is the living rooms are too small. These people are living in mud brick houses, and it's got everything that they own contained in usually not more than about two rooms is all they have. There's just not enough room. And during the monsoon period when the rains are heavy, you really need to be under a roof. So we were able to build this little structure for them. There are plastic sheeting underneath the thatch that you see on the roofs there, so it's watertight even in the heavy rains. And there are spaces to let the air pass through. That's the only ventilation that they have. This is a new colleague, Daniel Harper, who was just recently hired to work in the French-speaking parts of the world with me. He and his wife have moved to Atlanta now. He's getting some pastoral training with Mr. Bruce Gore, who also happens to be his father-in-law. Mr. Gore is a longtime pastor in the church. It's good for Mrs. Harper to be near her parents when her husband's away for a four-week trip in Africa, so she's got a nice support system there. This is Mr. Harper giving a Bible study in our little hall. And then we had a very happy event. I've been counseling with a couple of ladies for baptism, and one of them was ready to be baptized. I've been working with her for about a year. Usually baptismal counseling doesn't necessarily take that long, but when I can only visit twice or three times a year, it slows the process down. So this is mass transport. This is mass transportation in this part of Africa. You rent a trailer, hook it up to a motorcycle, and our whole church congregation rumbled down to the lagoon. And we had a baptism here in the lagoon just inside the shoreline. I asked Mr. Harper to do the actual baptism along with Paul Tia, one of our local leaders, and then we all did the laying on of hands. So this is our new sister in Christ. Her name is Elise. She's not really showing it very much here, but Elise was pregnant at the time of her baptism. And she didn't. It really wasn't showing much in the way of pregnancy. I had no idea how pregnant she was. But by the time we got back from our trip up north, which was only about 5 days, she'd given birth to a little baby. So I'll save that for when we get back to that part of the trip. So this is the group. This is a little congregation that meets in Lamé. So this is a very joyful occasion. Some of them don't look too joyful. This is often the case with African photos, and maybe I've explained this to you before, but I asked them one time, why do you always look so serious when you have your photo taken? In America, we smile when we have photos taken. And they said, well, it's like this. If you smile, it means life is really good for you. And that can only mean you've come into some money. That's about the only thing that makes people smile. You've come into some money. If you've come into some money, members of your family have a right to their share. So if they see you smiling, they're going to be coming with their hands out, I want my share. And if you don't have it to give to them, they think they're holding out on you, and this causes big problems in the family. So when we have our photos taken, we look really serious, even if we're happy inside. So that's why I've been working with them gradually. I can actually get some of them to smile now. You may see in some other photos, you may see smiling people. And the reason is because I promised them I will not show this photograph in Africa. This will only be shown outside of Africa. And so I have one where they're looking really stern and sometimes one where they're smile. So you may keep an eye out for that later on. After we had our meeting in Lamé, the little village, then we started a long trip. Takes about 7 or 8 hours drive over some roads that I'll show you here shortly. to the region of Man, which is where this arrow ends up. Man is one of the larger cities in Ivory Coast. And interestingly, when I first started visiting people here, the Civil War was still going on, and there was an interior line. I actually had to pass from government-controlled territory into rebel-controlled territory in order to be able to visit these people. So we would pull up at there was a border crossing. There were armed guards there. They would check my passport, write down the information. I had to pay them a fee to be able to get in and get out. And thankfully now that's all over with the end of the Civil War, so we can travel a bit more safely now. But at the time, that's what it was to get into Man. One thing I'll point out to you here, you'll notice that just to the west of where we are, you have Guinea and Liberia. And that probably rings a bell with you if you've been watching the news over the course of the last couple of years. This is where the big Ebola outbreak occurred. And many of our church brethren live even farther west than Man. So they're within, in some cases, 30, 40, 50 miles of the border, not really very far. And the health authorities were prepping themselves in Man. That's where the World Health Organization had set up a crisis center. In case Ebola came across the border, that would have been the epicenter. So we were very concerned for our church brethren there, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment as well. So it's interesting to travel on African roads because the official unemployment rate is usually 70 or 80% of people have no real employment. So most people just try to find a way to get by. This is true for many of our church brethren as well. One of the easiest things to do is to sell small objects in places where people might buy them. As it happens, any time on a French highway you're forced to slow down, or cars are regularly forced to slow down, there will be hawkers there waiting to try to sell you something in your car. So you see, whenever a car slows down, you see these young people are running. They're sprinting up along next to the car. When they catch you, they'll press all of these things up against the window, hoping that you'll buy something. These are cola nuts. That's what they put in Coca-Cola or Coke products. That's what keeps you up at night. If you chew one of these, you can run a marathon. So that's what people – so they've got apples, and they've got toilet paper, and they've got Fanta, and they've got puppies, and they've got calendars, and they've got – anything you can imagine, and I guarantee you some things you would not imagine, all of that is being sold to you, or they're attempting to sell it to you. And as you saw in the previous one, if it looks like you're interested and the driver pulls away, they'll sprint alongside the car as long as they can, just hoping that maybe you'll buy some of whatever it is that they have. The roads are not very safe. We counted half a dozen traffic accidents that destroyed a vehicle on the way up to Yamoussoukro, which is the capital of the country. And in Yamoussoukro, we came across a bread truck. So these are loaves of French bread. And this brings a couple of things to mind. One is, any place the French were the colonizers, they always keep some elements of French cuisine, because French cuisine is really delicious. So any African country that was a former French colony, you can get a good baguette. In the former English colonies, they didn't keep the cuisine. The English are not, that's not what they're good at. So there's no English, maybe tea, but that's about, they like the government, you know, they like the Magna Carta and all that, but not the cuisine. So the second thing I want to mention is these are loaves of bread that are just stuck in the back of a truck. And this is a dusty, gritty, sandy place. This is all blowing around like this. And there's no plastic on these loaves. So whoever bought these got a bonus that they weren't expecting. Now, here I want to show you, this is a World Health Organization map, and you'll see the parts in the kind of brownish and then the yellowish or orange. These are the areas where the Ebola outbreak was the worst. And the little red dot that you see in Ivory Coast, that's where Man is located. And the Ebola cases came right up to the border in Liberia, as you can see. So it was a very, very close thing. They're not sure exactly how Ebola jumped from the Congo, which is where the first cases showed up years ago. They don't know how it jumped all the way over to West Africa, a couple of thousand miles away. It's really a long ways away. But what they suspect, one of the best possibilities of how the Ebola made it over there, was through an animal population, most specifically bats. Bats migrate, and it's known that bats are a reservoir for Ebola. Bats can carry Ebola and can transmit it as well. So while we're in this part of the country, when the Ebola outbreak was at its height, the health authorities said, well, what they told us was avoid the bat soup. I said, no problem. It's actually kind of a specialty here. It's kind of spicy. They put a lot of pepper in it, and people really like the bat soup. We were not interested in that. But even at the Feast of Tabernacles last year, the health authorities, it was serious enough that they had outlawed, they said you can't eat meat at all. The reason for that is not that they were worried about cows and chickens, that type of meat, but what a lot of people eat is called bush meat. And bush meat means basically anything that was alive that comes out of the bush, out of the trees. And I mean anything. And I'll give you some examples here in a moment. I'll show you some examples of what passes for bush meat. The authorities were afraid that if they allowed any meat consumption, people were going to continue slipping their bush meat in along with the beef and the chicken. So they just said no meat at all. So at the Feast of Tabernacles last year in Man, our church brethren were not able to eat any meat during the feast. The only animal protein they could eat was fish. So they ate fish every day during the Feast of Tabernacles. And they were happy to have it. They like fish there. But that's just to give you an idea of how serious this was. Now, I said I would give you some ideas of what bushmeat is. These are giant forest snails. And these boys were out in the forest. They'll pick up a bowl full, and then they'll just stand on the side of the road, and they'll hold them out to cars whizzing by, and if you want to buy some snails, you just stop and say, I'll take two or three or whatever. I'm told that they taste like chicken. This is something else that you commonly see in some parts of rural Africa. These are forest crabs. They're about this big, and they'll gather those up, and they tie them up live on these branches, and they'll hold those up as well. There's very little refrigeration, so they'll try to keep the animal alive as long as possible. This is another specialty in this part of Africa. They call them in English grass cutters. In French, they're called agouti. You're probably thinking of another name right now when you look at these. They do look very much like other rodents that we might find in our neck of the woods. I'm told they more or less taste like chicken as well. Apparently almost everything tastes like chicken. So these have just been recently killed. They can sell them that way for a day or two in the heat. After that, what they'll do is they smoke them, and that's what you see here on the left side of the slide. They've laid them out and they've smoked them, and then they can keep them a few more days that way and try to sell them along the side of the road. Now, I don't know how clearly, actually, you've got a good projector here. This is great. You notice the thing on the two animals that are on, well, I'm not sure what the lower right one is, but the one in the back on the right, if you can see that, that's actually something that's often called a flying fox. It's a giant bat. And that's what that one's been smoked as well, and that's what they would put in the soup. So these are the kinds of things that you'll commonly see in marketplaces and even held up on the side of the road. I've seen pythons, I've seen monkeys, that's pretty common. Every once in a while there'll be a clean animal. I did see an antelope once on this last trip, but mostly it's unclean animals and of all sorts of varieties, things that we probably wouldn't contemplate eating. But they think that that is how the Ebola probably spread over to West Africa, was in the flying bat population, and then someone killed a bat and either got some of the blood or there was some sort of contamination that way. And that one of the best explanations of how the Ebola made it to West Africa. The road gets steadily worse as we go up toward Man. It starts out quite good, then it turns to dirt and gradually. The vehicles are not in very good shape. The large truck in the center of this photo had just broken down, so it's right in the middle of the road broken down. They're trying to work on it and get it fixed, and we had to drive around. Finally, we made it to Man itself, and Man has made a lot of progress since I first went there. When I first went there, it was during the war was still going on. Everything of value had been looted out of the city. The hotels had been picked clean. There was you couldn't get a meal in a hotel because all of their silverware, their plates, everything had been taken. And there was no pavement on the road. Everything was dusty because there was just dirt on the roads. And now they've got it repaved, and some of the banks are being reopened and rebuilt. And so there are some signs of progress. We arrived here just about 3 hours before it was time to hold the Passover ceremony in the evening. And this is the place where we held the Passover, in this little room. Here was our setup for the foot washing in the evening before the sunset. And let me just go back one here if I can figure out how do we do that. Yeah, I had a rather interesting experience here. And this is because Côte d'Ivoire is relatively new to the Church of God. To my knowledge, we've not had any members here prior to about the last 6 or 7 years, and that started with trips that I made up there as a result of someone having come across. It actually goes all the way back to the Plain Truth magazine in French. And then it's a longer story than I can tell you right now, but basically people were getting the Plain Truth. They made contact. I went to visit them. And through word of mouth and personal example, other people became interested in the truth. But where I'm going with this is it was a very interesting situation for me. I'd never had this happen before. Everybody that took the Passover, we were about 20 that night, I had baptized all of them. except Mr. Harper and obviously myself. But that was just to show that this is a pretty new chapter that's opening now in the history of the Church of God. To my knowledge, this is the first time we've ever had baptized members in this country. The next day, the day after the Passover service, on Passover Day, we made a big loop around and visited a number of areas where we have prospective members and little groups that are growing. Let me tell you how this started. I think you'll find this interesting. This is an area where a lot of people are illiterate, and many people don't speak French. You may not know it, but most of the people that we serve in the French department don't speak French, because the bulk of them are in Africa, and most of them hear the truth through somebody who speaks French and who can translate it for them into whatever their local language is. And their local language is different in every country, and sometimes multiple languages inside a single country. So we do a lot of things by translation. So we've got a little core group, as I mentioned, about 20 baptized members there. And the local men got together and they said, what can we do to help spread the gospel? Is there something we can do? We can't print literature. People can't read it in French. What is it that we can do? These men are mostly farmers, and it's not hard to get a plot of ground to farm. So what they said was, we're all going to each move to a different village, and we're going to be lights. We're just going to live a Christian life in these villages. And when people ask us questions about why we keep the Sabbath on Saturday instead of Sunday, we'll be able to answer their questions. And so they did. And here we are now, a couple of years on, we actually have little groups that are meeting on the Sabbath of people who have noticed that something was different, asked their questions, got good answers out of the Bible as to why they were doing that. And so we actually have a growing presence. Not everybody understands a lot yet, but they're very interested. And in each village that we went to, the village chiefs were aware of what was happening. And a normal protocol is that you have to be received by the chief or given approval by the chief before I, as a pastor, could teach people in his village. So we went to 8 different villages on this day. It was one right after another all day long. We would, if necessary, be received by the chief. The chief would usually offer us hospitality. I'm not sure who did this in the Coca-Cola bottling company, but somebody had a brilliant idea. And I don't know how they did it, but in most of West Africa, the best way to show a visitor hospitality is to offer him an orange Fanta. So I drank 8 orange Fantas. Probably not 8, but it felt like that by the end of the day, just about everywhere we went, and you'll see that in the pictures. But this is what the roads were like. We needed a 4-wheel drive to get out to these villages that are really off the beaten track. So what would happen is we'd be received by the village authorities. They would welcome us, give us the keys to the village, and then they would usually offer us a Fanta, and then they would invite me to speak to them. So I would give the equivalent of a sermonette about some topic out of the Bible that they might be interested in. I talked about the holy days. In a couple of villages, there were beloved village members who had died recently. So I talked about resurrection, something that they would find interesting. Then I'd answer questions for a few more minutes, and then we'd get back in the car and drive on. And it was just a chance for people to meet us and for us to see them. And because it carries a lot of weight. They don't see a lot of Westerners out here, light-skinned people, and for us to come all the way out to their little village to talk with them and talk to them about the truth, it carries a lot of weight with them. So here was our first village of the day. Here was our second village of the day, and we just went from place to place. This is another one. The gentleman in white in the center there is the chief, and he wanted to receive us personally and ask us, said we were free to teach in his village, and would we please build a nice big church building? And I said, we'll see. Here's another one. This was a very colorful one. You see the chief in the center there with a hat and his cane. The cane is a symbol of his chieftainship. And then you see he's got some rather colorful advisors on both sides. I think, you can see them pretty well here, at least if you're up close. So we're sitting under a tree and answering questions. Yet another village. I won't bother giving you all the names. This is where most of our work started, in this part of Côte d'Ivoire. This is the little village of Yaplu, and this is where I baptized the first people in this part of Côte d'Ivoire. And we have a path. We have a little jungle stream, and it really looks like a jungle stream, and that's where we do our baptisms. And so probably about a third of these people are baptized members. And this is a church building that they had built themselves in the back. And interestingly, the previous visit that I'd made here to Yaplu, I was informed that I had been adopted by the chief. I thought, this is great. I'm going to inherit an African village. And when the chief isn't there any longer, and I was kind of getting excited about that. My wife was worried about what was I going to do with the chief's wives when that happened. But as it turns out, he has lots of other sons adopted and real, and so what it really meant was I could have a bedroom in his house when I came if I wanted one. So that was still a very nice gesture. So we're warmly welcomed here. This is Mr. Harper on the first day of Unleavened Bread, giving a sermonette, and this was, the last time he wore a jacket. Usually you try that once in this part of Africa, and after that you don't do that anymore. I've soaked through, before I learned that lesson, I would soak through a jacket completely. That's how hot and humid it is. And you'll notice that they're trying to decorate as well as they can with what they have. You see they put some cloth on the front of this little lectern. They don't have very much, but they try to do the best they can to honor God and honor the occasion with what they have. In fact, you probably see these little plastic yellow flowers that they've stuck around on the floor. That's just to try to beautify the hall as best they can. So they do their best. Just another view as we started the service. And then we drove about an hour, and we had an afternoon service in another location. So as many people as possible could attend. You notice he's not wearing his jacket in this slide. And you also know this is a fellow in yellow standing here. This is where I mentioned he's our translator. And to speak to them, he says a sentence in French, and it's translated into the local language. And we say another sentence and so on. So that means you either take twice as long or you say half as much if you're going to stay within your time. So here's the translator. He's got his Bible in the local language out, and he'll read the scriptures in their local language. And this is a hall that they specifically put together to be their church hall also. So, and they've done very, especially by local standards, they've done very well with it. This is where we ate during the time that we were in Man. As I mentioned to you, there are no real restaurants. They have these things, which are just bush restaurants. And there are two things on the menu. There's fish and chicken. They have no refrigeration, so it's all fresh, we hope. And they just lay it out on the counter there, and you walk up and say, I want this fish or I want half of this chicken, and it disappears, and an hour later, it shows up on a plate in front of you. And it does take an hour, so you can't be in a hurry there. Now, I did a little zoom in here. These are not raisins on the chicken or the fish. You have to kind of go like this before you can pick out which one you want and hope that it's well cooked by the time it gets back. The next day, after the Holy Day, we had a full day of leadership training seminars, and this is a really important activity for us because, as I mentioned, we're only able to go in and visit these areas once or twice a year. And so it's not possible for us really to work personally other than helping people prepare for baptism. That I do handle personally with those that are ready, and we usually have to devote a day to baptismal counseling when we're up there. But we try to spend a day in leadership training, and we cover things like this time we had three different lectures that we presented. One was on the importance of faithfulness in the little things and in the big things among leaders in the church. Mr. Harper gave one on encouraging to teach God's truth to their children and how to go about doing that. And then they had asked a question about the role of women in church. And so they wanted to know what the Bible taught about that. What's happening in some of the Western countries where that doctrine or understanding has changed in many mainstream churches even, that's trickling out into other areas of the world. And so they just said, what does the Bible say? And it actually is quite nice to work with them in some of these areas because if you can prove to them what the Bible says, that's all they want to know. Okay, there's no reasoning about it. There's no, well, I think times have changed and we need to. No, it's just tell me what the Bible says. So there it is. Thank you. That's all we need. So it was a very productive time. Then we also leave another session just for questions and answers. And if I had some time, I'll just give you a list of some of the really unusual questions that we get in some of these Q&A sessions. But these are very productive. So that was a whole day of leadership training. This was where we had them do some breakout work, and that's a new concept to them. They were very excited to do that. And here was our group portrait. You notice most of them haven't gotten the smile thing down yet. But this was our lead. In fact, even Mr. Harper's not smiling in this one, I think. So this was our leadership training group for this session up in Man. Then we did the 7-hour road trip back once again to get back to Abidjan. And just when we got there, we found that she had given birth to a little boy early that morning. And what was interesting was she had given birth probably about 6 or 7, maybe 8 hours earlier. Is that right? Yeah, that would be about right. And just as we got there, she was being released from the clinic, and they were expecting her to walk about 2 miles back to her house with her baby. There was no transportation. That's just what women do there. So since we rolled up in a vehicle, that turned out to be quite a blessing for her, because she and her two sisters who were there to help her, we got all of them in the back seat of the car and drove her to her house, which made her somewhat of a minor celebrity in town. There are no cars to speak of in this town, and so to roll up in a nice sedan with air conditioning, you know, and a couple of white guys getting out, and that was big happenings here. So then we flew on. That was the end of our time in Côte d'Ivoire. We flew on to Togo. Togo is lives under a dictatorship, a relatively benevolent dictatorship, but things work pretty good. And we actually have some of our better educated members here. Two of them actually own automobiles. These are the only two members that we have in all of French Africa that own their own automobile. We have a couple that own motorcycles, but that's just it's just something that most people can never even dream of doing. This looks like a rather scary thing, but I wanted to explain something that's happening because of Ebola. What this woman is not actually robbing the lady there. She's holding up an infrared thermometer and pointing at her forehead. And they've got these infrared thermometers now that from a distance they can tell what temperature you have. And every time you go through an airport in West and Central Africa, you're screened for your temperature now. They want to know if you've got a fever. And if you've got a fever, they have health personnel standing by to take you aside and give you a further checkup before they let you either leave or enter the country. Sometimes you have to fill out health forms. They want to know where you were. Were you in contact with anybody that had a fever or was bleeding, or, you know, all the things that you would ask. Sometimes they ask, what airline seat were you sitting in, so they could trace you, track you down, in case someone on the plane gets sick later on. So they're trying to do the best they can with this, but you can see the lady doesn't look too happy. She doesn't understand what's happening here, since someone's just pointing this pistol-like thing at her forehead, and she doesn't know what's going on there yet. I don't know how well you can see this, and I apologize if anybody gets grossed out by this, but this is what we had in our – this is what was shown in our hotel. When we arrived in the lobby of the hotel, they had this. So this is how you can recognize signs of Ebola, and some of them are quite graphic, so I'll just leave it at that. But these are the kinds of things that you see along the side of the road. You can buy almost everything on the sidewalk in Africa. A lot of people can't afford to have much of a stall, so they spread their wares out. Has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. I'm sure Abraham would have seen scenes very similar to this in the towns and cities that he walked through. So this is a, just kind of a colorful fruit stand that we pass by. Almost everything is sold out on the street. You'd be amazed at things you can buy on the sidewalk in Africa. Furniture, couch sets, coffins, just about anything is for sale out on the sidewalk. So, this is actually the home of one of our church brethren. This is a porch, one of his kind of a more or less screened-in room that you can see here. The bars on the windows are to keep burglars from breaking in. They have to have bars on all their windows for safety's sake, but it lets a little bit of air in. So this is normally where they hold both Bible studies and Sabbath services, and here we are for a Bible study. And this is what it looks like during the daytime. Here's Mr. Harper presenting his parenting seminar. This was appropriate for the whole church, so he presented his seminar presentation on that. A lot of the roads are not in very good shape. This is during the heavy rains. The roads are all sand. This is very near the sea, so you get these huge holes that sometimes the holes are so deep, the whole car drives down into it and drives back out on the other side. So I hesitate to call them potholes because it's really – I have to think of a better term. In French, the term for pothole is chicken nest, kind of colorful. We dubbed them elephant nests for some of them. So this is a photo of me along with the group. This is a very faithful group. And who showed a lot of discernment as well. When the trouble was going on in our recent, our past association, they were just reading the letters coming out, and when I arrived to visit them one time, they said, something is wrong, tell us what it is. It's very obvious from this communication we're getting from Cincinnati, what's going on, please tell us. Please be up front with us and tell us what's going on. So it was quite interesting to see the discernment that was there, which often is a gift of God, isn't it? Oops, that's a little too far. The next stop was Cameroon, and the arrows that you see down at the bottom show our starting place was Douala, which is a coastal city. It's the economic capital of Cameroon. And then we went to Yaoundé to the east, which is the political capital of the country. Then we went up north to a rural village where we have a couple of members and interested people. And then we went backtracked and we went to another rural village where some longtime members of the church, a longtime church family, was asking questions. They had been with a different Church of God association and were looking for a new home. And so they asked me if I would come and visit them as well. The oval shape that you see here on the map, this is the area where Boko Haram has been doing a lot of its incursions. That's the area along the border where they've killed a lot of people, and they particularly target Christians for reasons, no other reason than the fact that they're Christian. And on several occasions, they've actually come across the border into Cameroon. They circle up all of the villagers in a village. They line them up against a wall, and then they go right down and they say a prayer, say an Islamic prayer, say a prayer in Arabic. And if they don't know how to do it, they shoot them. And then they go on and they just go down the line. And they may massacre 50, 100 or more people, and they pile back into their vehicles and they leave again. So the whole country is really traumatized by this. Even areas that are pretty far away from where they've been operating, there's a palpable fear. And even people in the far south of the country were talking about Boko Haram. They're very concerned about that. The village where we were going to visit the two members the village is over 100 miles away from where these incursions have been, but we thought we probably shouldn't take a chance because they've publicly stated on a number of occasions that what they really want to do is kidnap Westerners because that's what gets all the publicity. And we figured making a visit in there during the day, unannounced, and leaving again that same day, not too risky. Spending the night might give people time to spread the news, and at least that was our thinking. So we didn't spend the night in the village, but we did go up to see some of the members. This is Boko Haram. They've kidnapped many young girls, teenage girls in Nigeria, and they've sold them as slaves or concubines or whatever. They're very heartless. This is the road leading to Yaoundé. So this is Central Africa, very much a jungle environment. The road was closed at one point by an accident, so we had to leave the paved road and take a back trail through the bush in order to continue our trip. And to make a long story short, after basically almost a full day on the road, we were able to visit Jules, who's on the left here, and Simon, who's standing next to him, and then the lady and children, that's Jules' wife, and this is his house. He's been a member since all the way back. It's been 20 years now or more that he's been a church member, and I first met him 20 years ago, actually. So we've known each other for quite a long time. Very faithful in rather difficult circumstances. Here they are holding up a French edition of Discern magazine. We do produce that in French. And one of our church calendars, we produce a church calendar, wall calendar in French each year because so many of our brethren in the French-speaking areas are scattered and they don't see a lot of other church brethren. They're very isolated. We like the idea of a calendar to put on the wall where they would have pictures of brethren, part of that region, and it really makes them feel like they're a part of something, not just cut off and isolated, but they're part of something bigger than themselves. So everywhere we go, we see these calendars on the walls, and it's very heartwarming for them. You see the soft drink on the table in front of me. That was the welcome drink. Then we backtracked and we made it to another village, and this time it's farther south in Cameroon. Not actually the first time I've been to this village, but the last time I was there was years and years and years ago. And so this is the family that we came to visit. The lady on the left, her name is Melanie. She grew up in the church. Her father was a member of the church. He's since died. This goes back to Worldwide days. And she's kind of the matriarch of the family now. And she was very happy to have us come and visit with them. They ask us questions for hours and hours about the recent history of the church, what happened, and then had Bible questions as well. And so we spent the latter half of one day with them, and then part of the morning the next day, and spent the night in the village. This is Melanie's kitchen. This is what most ladies in the area will cook over. They get three or four rocks, build a fire in the middle, and put their pots on top. And Melanie actually was quite proud of her kitchen. She asked me to take this picture. Please take a picture so people can see what a well-equipped kitchen I have, because she's got all these pots and pans, and many people don't have things like that. So you can see it's just a mud and wattle construction with a dirt floor. There's another member of the family who's doing the dishwashing, and that's the way it's always done. They sit on little short stools so they can work on pots off the ground, and that's how they wash. But in spite of that, they were able to put on a real feast. As you can see here, they had braised fish and beef and chicken, and they had roast bananas. There's actually a variety of banana called plantain, which is not sweet like a banana. It's just a little tiny bit sweet. So it's almost like a potato if you grill it right, and that's the way they use plantain. And they even managed to buy a bottle of French wine, which shows what a special occasion it was for them, because that's not something they would normally be able to do. So this gentleman on the left here has grown up in the church and around the church. He's well into his adult years now. But he asked, he said he was finally willing to make the commitment, would I help him start preparing to be baptized? So that's always encouraging when after years and years, he's probably in his 30s now, he's ready to begin preparing for that commitment. So we had a first visit with him, and I left some literature for him to begin studying. That was encouraging. The next stop was the Congo. So we flew on to Congo, and this is what a lot of vehicles look like from the inside in Congo. You can't change a windshield just because it's cracked. It's too expensive. So as long as there are no holes in the windshield, you'll keep going with it as long as possible. Congo is one of the most corrupt countries in the world, and it's also one of the most violent countries in the world. The largest UN peacekeeping force in the whole world is located in the Congo. There are outbreaks of military type incursions that happen frequently in the country. In recent history, there's sometimes been three different wars going on in the Congo at the same time, and they're unrelated to each other. They're three separate wars between different groups. So it's not an easy country in which to live. The infrastructure has completely fallen apart. They've actually invented, a bit tongue-in-cheek, they've invented a new name for the governmental system in the Congo. You know, we have democracy, or we have a republic. They've created the term kleptocracy. If you recognize what klepto means, what a kleptomaniac, someone who can't stop stealing. So klepto is the prefix having to do with theft. So you have a kleptocracy, it's government by the thieves, because anybody who gets in charge fills his pockets as quickly as he can, because he doesn't know how long he's going to be able to hold on to power. And the people just live in abject poverty, and it's really not improving. It's getting worse all the time. This is just a street corner. They're doing something. I don't know what. This is the kinds of scenes that you often see. We did make some visits out to visit some of the local members while we were there. This is what it's like to do the back streets of Kinshasa. These ladies, you'll notice, I was happy to see they actually have plastic on the bread here, but this is a typical situation for a woman who doesn't have a normal job, which is almost everybody. They'll all find some little commercial thing that they can do. These ladies go to a bread factory early in the morning. They buy one basket of bread, loaves like this. They spend the day walking around trying to sell them on the street. And whatever profit they can make by doing that, which is just a few cents a loaf, that's what they have for their day's work. And they do that every day. Most of them do it 7 days a week. That's how they live. We just recently, Mr. Franks approved us renting a house complex for the church there. We had to do this for a couple of reasons. One reason was that the government requires that once we are a registered church, we must have a fixed address. And that's because the government, if they want to come and get us, they want to know where to find us. That's the way dictatorships work. So we have to have an official address where they can find us if they want to. We also needed a meeting hall, which was getting more difficult. And this is also going to serve now as a Feast of Tabernacles site. So we already did that for the feast this last year. And it's actually a very high-quality meeting place for them, although the neighborhood is not as good as it could be. Here we are during Mr. Harper's sermonette. And this is the group that's meeting in Kinshasa now. We have about 70-plus people that are attending. And again, most of this is as a result of personal contact. They do have some of our literature A lot of people can speak French well here, so we don't have to translate our services. This is one of the few places where that's the case. And so they're able to distribute some of our literature in French. When we started out, we only had about 20 people attending. And now we're 5 or 6 years beyond that, probably a little more than that now, and we're up to 70 or 80. And I'm holding a class for about 10 people at a time now to help prepare them for baptism. So we should be having more baptisms here soon. And you'll notice nobody is smiling in this photo. This is one of the hardest places to live that of all the areas where I go. It's just very, very difficult. Prices keep rising. There's a huge UN presence. And when the UN is present massively, prices always skyrocket because the UN comes in and they can buy all the best stuff. They rent the best places. They buy the best stuff. And so automatically prices rise. Inflation is a big issue. Most of the men who have a job, their salary is just enough for them to rent a place to live. And whatever they're going to live on beyond that, they have to find something else to do beyond what their salary affords them. So it's very, very difficult for them. We try to bring in things that will help them when we travel. We brought in a couple of small laptops that we left with two different people. This is Mr. Harper giving some pointers on how to use Linux to one of our local leaders there. And you'll notice the orange Fanta, the ever-present orange Fanta. Can't get away from it. It's become a bit of a joke now when I got home from my trip because I'd written about this in my travel blog. Guess what was sitting on my desk in the headquarters office? A giant bottle of orange Fanta. As I mentioned, after we had intended to go to Burundi, that was supposed to be our next stop, but we were watching the news, we'd been talking with American authorities in Burundi, and even our local members said, we don't think you should come this time. And that's a real change for them. Usually they say, oh, no, there's no problem, just come on. And one time there were artillery shells falling in the nation, and I said, I don't think I'm going to go up country. And they said, what are you worried about? We're Christians. God's protecting us. We just need to do the work. And I said, well, Jesus did say you shall not tempt the Lord your God, and, you know, we want to use reasonable precaution. But this time, even they said, we don't think you should come, and it turned out to be a wise choice. So we just ended up having an extra 3 days in Kenya, and rather than sit in Nairobi, which is a very expensive, everything's expensive in Nairobi, for about the same, actually for less money, we were able to go out and spend those nights in one of the natural reserves that they have in Kenya. But before we go there, this is a shot that was taken 3 years ago of some of the church brethren that we have in Burundi. So we do have about 200 people attending our services there. So there are really quite a few. So what we did was I called up a contact that I have. I used to cover Kenya for the church in years past, so I've got some good contacts there. And we were able to arrange a trip out to one of the game parks where we spent a couple of nights. It's one of the best places in the world to view game, and there's a reason I'm showing you this. This isn't really just a vacation picture. We were still working while we were there and all of that. But this is the Mara River down below in front of the tent where we stayed. And the Mara, that's the one that you've seen in the National Geographic documentaries where the wildebeest are trying to jump over the river and the crocodiles are waiting for them. You've seen those? This is the river where that happens every year during the migration. And there are crocodiles and hippos down in this water. And the hippos actually are they're herbivores, and they come out at night to graze. They come out and graze like cows do. That's what they eat. And I mentioned that on the blog. I know some of you mentioned that you're reading that. But I woke up in the middle of the night in my tent, and I heard a washing machine off in the distance. And I thought, what's a washing machine doing out here? And then the washing machine kept getting closer, and it was making this washing machine sound. And I'm kind of half asleep and half awake, and it keeps getting closer and closer till it's right outside the tent. And then I woke up, and I realized that's a hippo grazing. And it was tearing the grass, and it made a sound that, to me, it sounded just like a washing machine, you know, turning like that. But the next morning, I went up and saw the footprints and stepped it off. It had been grazing 10 feet away from my head inside the tent. So that was kind of exciting. This is a pod of hippos that were down in the river, just down below the camp where we were. And as I mentioned, Kenya is one of the best places to see African wildlife. The variety of it and the conditions just make it absolutely stunning. Old bull elephant that we were able to get close to. He'd broken one of his tusks. Hyena. And we came across, there are lots of lions in the Mara area, and so you're guaranteed to see lots and lots of lions. And we did. We saw several different family groups. One of the most interesting things we watched was a group of lions finishing up the carcass of a zebra that they had killed earlier in the day. And these are really big cats. I mean, you've probably seen lions in a zoo, but they're big, they're powerful. And when you see them ripping into an animal carcass, they're bloody, and the power that the animals display, the ferocity when they're dragging an animal down, you really never, ever forget that. And it always makes me think of the verse in the Bible that talks about, compares our adversary to a roaring lion stalking around seeking whom he may devour. And I think that's a very, once you see a lion devouring something, you always think of that. And it really gets burned into your brain. And that was the case for me once again. Then we did something interesting, and this is why I wanted to just take a minute or two and talk about this. One of the things that we could do in this particular area of Kenya, which you can't do everywhere, is we were able to do a walking safari. So we're out walking the Serengeti Plain here with these two rangers. One of them had a 12-gauge pump shotgun, and the other one had a .458 Winchester Magnum, which will kill an elephant if you hit it in the right spot. And so they were our guards, and we just walked out among all the wildlife. There were no fences. We weren't protected other than these two fellows that were walking along there with us. They're Maasai, which is the tribe that lives in that area, and they're noted for their courage and their ferocity in battle in the old days. That's a hippo bone that Mr. Harper is holding there. The reason that this was so interesting to me was that Kenya has had problems with Al-Shabaab, and you probably heard that name in the news as well. Al-Shabaab is another Islamist group, and they're based in Somalia, but they've committed some horrible terrorist attacks in Kenya. And just recently, they killed 148 students in northern Kenya for no reason at all other than just to terrify people. Well, the Kenyans, they've had, there was a big terrorist attack, you probably remember that, in Nairobi last year or year before. And everybody's worried because nobody knows where this is going to pop up next. And when they found out, when these two Maasai fellows found out that we were pastors, they wanted us to give them a theological slant on what people were supposed to do. And one of them said to us very plaintively, he said, "What are we supposed to do? Who will protect us? The government can't protect us. The army can't protect us. Who is going to protect us?" He said, "We're Christians. Most Maasai are now, at least nominally Christian." He said, we know we're not supposed to take vengeance. We know we're not supposed to go the path of violence. But what do we do? They're killing us. Who's going to protect us?" And it was a very heartfelt, kind of plaintive, confused plea. Where do we turn now? And so we did the best we could to encourage them and talk about God's protection of those who do their best to follow his will. And even the fact that in the Bible, sometimes Christians are called upon to be martyrs, and Christ himself set that example. So we had a rather interesting theological discussion with these fellows as we're walking around looking at the wild animals. But the anguish that was in their voices was very palpable. What do we do? And I'd like you to hold that thought, because we're going to be facing a lot more of that as we go forward in time. As prophecies begin to be fulfilled, people are going to be asking that question. There's going to be a lot of confusion and anguish in the world. And we're going to come back to that before we close. But let me continue with the trip, first of all. The last country that we went to was here in Rwanda. This is what the streets look like in Rwanda. You'll notice you have to have a helmet to ride a motorcycle in Rwanda, one of the few places in Africa where that's true. And we drive up into the mountains a couple of hours out of Kigali. Rwanda is almost all hills like this. It's known as the Land of a Thousand Hills. And up on the top of one of them, about 2 hours out of town, after driving on sometimes not very good roads, this is a work party. Actually, I should tell you about the work party there. You'll find this. Tell me what you think would happen if they tried to do this in Texas. The government decided that in order to improve the country, They have declared that every fourth Saturday in the month, all citizens must report for duty to work on whatever project they're put to do. In this case, these villagers are repairing a road by hand using shovels, and they have to work most of the day like that. And if you don't show up for work, they might come and get you. And if you're driving around on that day, they will stop your vehicle, take you out of the car, and put you to work right there, wherever that project is. There are roadblocks all over the country. Something tells me that probably wouldn't fly very well in Texas, but that's what they do there. I once had a drunken policeman order me out of the vehicle. He was going to put me to work right there, and so we negotiated. I said, "Well, I have an appointment with the mayor up in the next town, but could I have your name so I could let him know the reason that I didn't make that meeting?" He said, "Oh, never mind. Go on." So anyway, we passed a work party on the way up there. And up on top of one of these hills, this is the village of Giti, and this is where we have our church hall. You can see it's quite a nice one. And we have about 70 people attending in Rwanda. Here's Mr. Harper giving a sermonette, and you can see the translator standing next to him at the lectern there, translating phrase by phrase. And we also had a day of leadership seminars for our local leaders, men and women, husbands and wives, and that was very helpful and positive as well. And then we actually went and visited some of the members in their homes. These are homes that they have built themselves. They're made out of mud brick. They make a plaster out of a little bit of plaster, maybe a little cement if they can afford it. I'm told they put a little cow dung in there. I'm not sure what that does, but apparently gives it better consistency or stickability or something. But that's what the houses are. That's what they're made of. And they make their houses themselves. They make the doors. They make everything. So nothing is a standard size. Mr. Harper was always having to bend over when he was come in and go out. But several of the people told us we would just go and sit in their living room for a few minutes and talk with them and ask how they were doing. And we had several of them said, "This means so much that you would come to my little house and sit here with me inside my house. It's an honor for us that you've come all this way." And several of them said, "This is really proof. This really makes us feel like we're a part of the church, that you would do this for us." And I mention that to you because, as I said at the beginning, you're helping to make this happen. By your participation in the work of the church, you're allowing us to go and help and serve these people. And it really is a lifeline for them all. Here's another. You can see they're holding Fantas. This is where we drank another Fanta once again. So this is another family, kind of a recomposed family where they're farming. All of these people are subsistence farmers. They grow what they eat, and they eat what they grow. And this was the last one that we visited. This fellow's name was Matthias, and he had a fascinating story to tell. When he was 19, he was just walking on the side of the road. An army truck pulled up. A bunch of big burly soldiers got out. They grabbed him, and they put him in the truck. He'd just been drafted. That's how they were drafting people in those days. They took him off to a training camp, and he spent the next 9 years in the Rwandan army. They sent him into the Congo. This was post-genocide. A lot of the people who committed the genocide fled into Congo, so the fighting continued over there. And he told us terrible stories about the things that he had to go through, not having enough food to eat, being forced to eat food that was actually dangerous to their health, seeing friends killed, inadequate medical help for those that were there, fighting soldiers from Zimbabwe who'd been sent up to back up the Congolese government and what have you. He said he really had lost hope. It really was in despair. But he stuck it out, and he made it. He left the army, and then he discovered the truth. And now he said now he's a happy man because he has a faithful wife. He has three sons. He has a little plot of land that he can farm. They're all in good health. And he also has the hope that all of us have as well. He understands why. While he was going through all this suffering, as many people do, they say, "Why? What is this about? Why do I have to go through all of this?" And now he understands the answers to those questions. And he was also one who said, "You know, there have been three times in my life when I have just been overjoyed. The first time was when Mr. Mundelli, that's our local elder in the area, when he first came to my house and sat in my house and answered my questions, I was overjoyed. Then Dr. Greg Schwartz, who's an elder in Kagwa, who's also a dentist by trade and has gone over and run some projects over there to help some of these people, give them dental treatments and things. He said, Dr. Schwartz came and sat in my house. And he said, and now you have come and you have sat in my living room. He said, I am overjoyed. This is one of three times in my life when I've been the most overjoyed. So just something little like that. Sometimes people in other groups say, just send them the money and let them sort it out. You know, we don't need to be going over there. That's not our part of the world. It's expensive to go. But it really is important, that personal contact. So we're doing the very best we can to serve our brethren in this part of the world. So that was our trip, 4 weeks worth. And we can bring the lights back up now. I'd like to talk to you about a couple of scriptures that we find in the Bible. Maybe give us some things to think about as we consider what we just saw. First of all, I wanted to give you an update on the situation in Burundi. This just came in 2 days ago. I asked one of our local members who lives in Bujumbura, the capital, what the situation is. And he wrote me back in French, and I translated it for you. So this is the latest from him. Hello, Pastor. Thank you for your message and for your support through your prayers. Regarding the political situation, things get worse by the day. People die without assistance. The government and its militias have destroyed all private radio stations and other media, including France 24, which is sponsored by the French government. And they have expelled even some foreign journalists. Houses and vehicles have been burned, and some streets in the capital have been destroyed by demonstrators. We are still alive, me and my family, and my neighborhood is almost calm since the beginning of the crisis. But life and daily activities are paralyzed. Children no longer go to school. To get out of the house, you need a parametric equation. And I assume he means to plot a safe course through all the things that are going on out there. Inside the country, specifically in Chibitoke, that's where most of our church brethren live, all our brothers are still well. I know because I communicated with Nathan last Saturday. He said that so far the situation remains good. Politically, the situation is blocked because the president is still radical in his position and the opposition is radical in their position. The Imbonerakure militia is armed to the teeth. In short, if we look at the evolution of things, the country has already crossed the line into civil war. The negotiations which were between the opposition and government have been blocked. The UN mediator has just resigned from his position. We are curious to see what the future holds. Thank you again for your help in prayer. And I hope you'll remember them as well, because that is a very, very difficult situation. Trips like the one I just described to you, and I do this a couple of times a year, I always come home with a mix of emotions, as I'm sure you can understand. They're tiring. Physically, they're tiring. I come home tired. And they're tiring emotionally, too, to see all the things that are going on there that we really wish we could help with. We wish we could fix, and we just can't at this point. There are some happy events. It's a good thing to see old friends. It's wonderful to be able to baptize someone and help them become a part of the body of Christ. It's wonderful to see babies born, see sometimes the help that we're able to give on behalf of the church. Those are happy times for us. But there are sad things, too, and even tragic things that we see very frequently in this part of the world. We see a lot of people who are living in fear, a lot of people who are suffering physically, health problems that can't be taken care of, or just there's abuse and violence, things we can't stop, even though we would really love to stop them. It's not exactly a helpless feeling, because we do what we can. We try to help as much as we can, and sometimes we can. But we do realize that the world is an unsafe place, and right now we're not in any position to be able to fix it. We just can't do that. I was particularly struck on this trip by how many evils were growing and affecting more and more people in this part of the world. We saw the effects of Ebola in West Africa and in the Congo. They had an outbreak there recently as well. There was Boko Haram in Nigeria and Cameroon. We saw the fear in people's faces. There's Al-Shabaab in Kenya, and they've threatened Burundi as well because Burundi has peacekeepers up in Somalia. There's civil unrest in Burundi that's ongoing and has killed a lot of people. And there's political unrest in a lot of other areas as well. I've never seen it this bad in Africa before. And I've talked to some of you here. We were talking even before services, and we're saying it's getting bad around here as well. We've never seen it this bad, you know, probably in most of our lifetimes, even in our own country. There are a lot of things we can still be thankful for and should be here in the United States, and I'm very aware of those things when I come home from these trips. I can turn on the tap water and I can drink it without worrying about it. There's a stable electrical grid. I don't have to worry about power outages every day, which most people or a lot of people in Africa do. If a policeman walks toward me, I don't have to worry that he's going to try and extort a bribe from me, which is usually the first thing I think when I see that happen in a lot of these places in Africa. We have good medical care. There's a whole host of things that we could be thankful for and that so many people in the world don't have. We have a lot of those blessings, perhaps most of those blessings, as a result of promises that were given to Abraham. And you probably noticed recently some of those blessings are being taken away. Things that we took for granted in the past, we just don't happen. We don't have them the same way that we had them in the past. The Western nations of the world are turning away from the Bible. And the more they do that, the more God's blessings are going to be taken away as well. it used to be safe in the United States, and we're having more and more unsafe things that are happening in this country now. There was 9/11, there was Fort Hood, there was attack in Garland, Texas not that long ago. That's only 15 miles from where our congregation meets in Dallas. When the Ebola outbreak happened, there were several cases in Dallas. They were treated in a hospital that was 4 miles away from where the church meets in Dallas. Those things that used to seem like they were really far away, they may show up next door. That's just the state of the world. And we heard about that in the sermonette. The U.S. is on a knife's edge now on certain moral issues that matter a great deal to God, whatever people may think about them. And if we go down the wrong road on some of those things, it's going to accelerate the withdrawal of God's blessings. There are weird things in the news now that we would never even have dreamed of. This gender identity thing that's suddenly taking over, what a strange thing. That we're mixing up our children in school by teaching them that nobody is 100% male or female. We're all on the sliding scale somewhere, and you need to figure out where you are. And it's just another disguise for sexual immorality and confusion. And now we're totally confusing, or preparing to totally confuse, the next generation. Persecution against Christians used to be something we read about in the history books. But you've probably had that thought in your mind recently, even looking at what's happening in the States. We can be persecuted now for having Christian beliefs. They can shut down people's businesses, or they can otherwise make it hard on you if you simply hold to the truths of what the Bible says. And things are going to get worse before they get better. Turn to Matthew chapter 24 with me, if you would. Matthew chapter 24. Let's read a couple of verses here. Matthew 24:21. I can remember Mr. Armstrong reading this passage many times. Then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. And the Greek indicates having your life saved. It doesn't, not talking about spiritual salvation here. It's talking about physical salvation. No one would survive unless those days were shortened. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. God's going to have to intervene to keep us from committing collective suicide. But at the same time that all of that is going on, go back to verse 14. Something else also must be going on. Verse 14 says, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached into all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come." So while this big crescendo is building up of the tribulation, the gospel still has to be preached in all the nations as a witness. As much as we are able to do it in the Church of God, we've got to continue doing that. That job will never end until we are simply physically incapable of doing it anymore. We've got to keep trying that to the best of our ability until the end. Just as God punished ancient Israel for their sins, our nation is going to reap what it has sown. But we are called to be faithful to God and to continue the mission He's given us, whatever is happening around us. And I think we need to think about that. We need to start bracing ourselves a little bit and preparing ourselves spiritually and emotionally for things that may be ahead. Some of our brethren in Africa, some of the people whose photos I just showed you, are doing their best to be Christians under a very real threat of war, torture, murder, and other things. And that's the environment they're living in. But they're still trying to be Christians. And that's what we're going to have to do too, whatever happens around us, whatever the circumstances may be. This made me think of 1 Peter chapter 3, because 1 Peter 3 has an interesting set of instructions for us. And these instructions are going to be true. They're always true. Whatever, as I said, whatever the environment in which we're living, whatever is happening around us, there are some instructions here that we're supposed to live, we're supposed to put into practice. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. 1 Peter 3:15. "Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear, having a good conscience, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed." They won't be ashamed right at that moment, but later on, when God decides to visit them, they will be ashamed. So Peter was helping to prepare members to face a hostile environment. He said they may revile you. They may call you names. They may be mean to you because you're representing Christ appropriately. And that, I believe, is the kind of social environment that we're heading toward. And in the light of that, those were the instructions that Peter gave to the congregation there. Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. Always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear, and have a good conscience. There are four different instructions there. Maybe we could even pick out more, but at least four. First of all, he said, sanctify God. What does that mean, to sanctify God? Sanctify means make a difference, put in a different category. And in the case of God, that means we've got to put God above all other values and priorities in life. That's what it means to sanctify God. It means he must be the first value in our life. Jesus said even above our own lives and the lives of our families would be faithfulness to God. And when we do that, when that is actually our first priority, then it's going to allow us to do these other things that we're supposed to do. But that's the starting point, to sanctify God, to put him above all other values. The second thing that Peter told the members to whom he was writing here was to be ready to give a reason for the hope that is in you. And that means a couple of things. We've got to be ready to give an answer, which means we've got to be aware of what the answers are. And the only way we can really do that is to be studying God's Word. That's the only way we're going to be ready to give an answer. We've got to have those thoughts ready to mind, know what the answers to those big questions are. That means we'll be thinking about them and studying them, and maybe even practicing as a game with husband and wife. How would you answer this question? How would you answer this question? Nothing wrong with doing something like that. We're just preparing to give an answer. But it also says a reason of the hope that lies within us. And I believe it's obvious. One thing that means is we've got to keep that hope alive and vibrant in us. And it will be tempting sometimes to let that hope go. When things get really bad all around us, we want to make sure we don't lose that hope. And how do we keep that hope in us? How do we keep it vibrant and alive? Well, we do that by reading the promises for the future. We do that by meditating on those things, all the promises that God has given for the future. That's what's going to keep that hope alive in us. If we don't have that hope in us and that confidence, we can't share it with anybody else, can we? We can't give a reason, an answer, or the reason of the hope that's in us if we don't have that hope in us. So it's important to hang on to that. A third instruction there is that when we answer, we're supposed to do it with meekness and respect. That's a way of life Christians are called to live. And I'm sure you've noticed that as I have. Meekness and respect is rapidly not the way most people are living in our country now. More and more people are not humble. They're not respectful. If you're not thinking the right thoughts, whatever they believe that's supposed to be, they think they have a right to be mean to you. They don't owe you any respect anymore. And our civil discourse in the country is becoming full of violence and hatred, not physical violence necessarily, but verbal violence, calling names and just treating with great disrespect. And again, we have to be careful we don't get caught up in that environment, because we're called upon to live lives of meekness, of humility, to live in humility and respect for other people. That is supposed to be a way of life for us, for Christians. And that's a way that our light is going to shine, because the world's going to be going a different way by and large. And then the fourth instruction we have is in verse 16. It says, having a good conscience. We're supposed to keep a clear conscience. How do we do that? How do we keep a clear conscience? Well, first of all, it means obey God. Don't sin, right? That's how we have a clear conscience. We know we don't have any, you know, we're living appropriately. But of course, nobody does that perfectly, so we are going to sin at times. And when that happens, we need to repent and have those sins forgiven. We need to get cleaned up by God's grace and forgiveness once again so that we can know that our conscience is clear. Those sins of the past have been covered. I thought very interesting that in the context of a time when people may be defaming us because of Christianity, and that was the situation Peter was addressing, he said, here are four specific instructions, the things you need to be doing in order to well represent God. These things are going to be a challenge as the world goes over its edge. It's going to be tempting for us to pull into our shells like turtles and just try to survive and let the world go its way. But we're still called upon to be lights. I'd like for us to consider before we close an admonition that God gave to one of his servants in a similar circumstance to what we're facing today. This was during the days of Jeremiah. I don't know if you've studied Jeremiah's life recently, but I think he's one of the most amazing prophets in the Old Testament. He was called by God to work in the last days of the kingdom of Judah in the decades before its conquest by the Babylonians. Jeremiah was called on to faithfully deliver God's warning to the kings of the nation and to the people that if they didn't repent and turn to God, they would end in destruction and slavery. And he did this faithfully for 40 years. For 40 years, he pleaded with Judah to repent and return to God, and they would not. He lived and worked under the authority of some good men, some evil men, some weak men, some self-willed and ambitious men, and he faithfully did the work of God. He was hated by most of those in authority because he told them truths they did not want to hear. Sound familiar? Jeremiah was of a priestly family. He was well off. His family was well off. Jeremiah can be translated as the Lord exalts. Perhaps that showed that his family had high hopes for him. He was going to rise to an important and prominent position. Maybe that's what his parents hoped for him. He'd be successful in life. But God called him to a different path. And as far as we know, and all that Jeremiah had to go through for those 40 years, as far as we know, he only had one faithful associate. And that was his secretary, whose name was Baruch. Baruch also came from an influential family of noble birth. He was the grandson of the governor of Jerusalem under King Josiah. His brother had been the chief chamberlain in the court of Zedekiah. He was a very talented, capable, well-educated man. And he also was called of God to work in very difficult times. And God had a special message for Baruch that we read in Jeremiah 45. I find this quite an amazing chapter, and I believe it's thought-provoking and applicable for us today. Jeremiah chapter 45. God sends a special message to Baruch. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spoke to Baruch, the son of Neriah, when he had written these words in a book, and the words written in a book apparently refers back to chapter 36, if you want to check that a little bit later, a book about the punishments that were going to come on Judah if they didn't repent. When he had written these words in a book at the instruction of Jeremiah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to you, O Baruch." So this was a special personal message to Baruch, to Jeremiah's secretary. Verse 3, "You said, 'Woe is me now, for the Lord has added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest.'" Baruch grieved to have to foretell these things, and his grief and his pain apparently were wearing him out. Those grievous emotions that he was experiencing, they just exhausted him. And apparently at some point he said those words, "This is just too much. Woe is me." They're adding insult to injury. It's just getting to be too much. The Lord has added grief to my sorrow. Verse 4, "Thus you shall say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, behold, what I have built I will break down, and what I have planted I will pluck up, that is, this whole land.'" In other words, we could maybe paraphrase that as saying, Baruch, you're living in momentous times. An important part of my plan, my perfect plan, an important part of it is about to be carried out in your lifetime. And it's going to cause pain to some people. That's necessary to the fulfillment of my plan. I'm going to fulfill my plan. It's got to be accomplished and fulfilled as I set it out from the beginning. And you have a part to play in that plan. Stick to my plan. That's what you have to do. Verse 5, "Do you seek great things for yourself?" Maybe Baruch was wishing that he could have gone a different career path. "Man, if I'd known what it was going to be, what it would be like to be Jeremiah's secretary, I would never have accepted this job. I could have been a banker, you know, I could have done something else." "Do you seek great things for yourself?" God says, "Do not seek them. You can have your plans, but my plan takes precedence." That's what God told Baruch. Do not seek them. Behold, I will bring adversity on all flesh. This is going to happen to the whole nation, Baruch. You wouldn't be able to escape it anyway, says the Lord. But I will give your life to you as a prize in all places wherever you go. Baruch was not supposed to be concerned about his own welfare or his position or his plans or his ambitions. He wasn't supposed to be self-seeking at this crucial time in the history of Judah. The nation was suffering a drastic judgment. And instead of making demands, as he apparently was thinking in some of his thoughts, instead of making demands on God, he should be satisfied that his life was spared and that he was allowed to play a part in the plan of God that was being carried out. And there's a suggestion, even in all the places where you go, I'll give you your life. There's kind of almost the suggestion there that he was going to have to flee for his life from place to place, but God would watch over him even in dire circumstances such as that. I think there are some applicable lessons there for us. As things become more difficult in our nations and in the world, it's going to be important for us to stay focused on God's plan and not just our own plans. It's not wrong to have plans. It's not wrong to plan. It's especially important for young people to plan. We should have some ambitions and some plans for ourselves, but we always have to remember that God's plan has to take precedence, and we're called to perform a particular mission, to play a particular role. Our main focus, what is most important to us, means faithfully fulfilling the responsibilities that God has given to us. His plan is what truly counts. His plan is what must truly be accomplished. So remember Baruch. Remember God's admonition to Baruch. And let's continue to do our part.